Hello and welcome to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I am the journal's news and online editor. Today I'm talking with Dr. Justin Ng, an early career researcher and resident at Peninsula Health, southeast of Melbourne. Justin has teamed up with Emeritus Professor Neville Yeomans from the University of Melbourne to conduct a meta-analysis on the association between low-dose aspirin use, the presence of Helicobacter pylori and upper gastrointestinal bleeding. Justin waded through over 3,000 papers in his search for data, and his results have made a robust addition to the evidence base. Welcome to the pod, Justin. I know there's a risk of UGI bleeding with H. pylori.
Yes.
How often does that happen? What's the prevalence of that?
The incidence of upper gastrointestinal bleeding in Helicobacter pylori infection is actually, we don't really know. But there are a few reasons for this. First one is that the prevalence of H. pylori infection varies quite significantly depending on where you are in the world. So geography affects it. And generally speaking, developing countries have a higher prevalence compared to developed countries because of the socioeconomic factors and that sort of thing. Aside from the socioeconomic factors, I think in the Middle East and Southeast Asian countries, there's a particularly high prevalence. So depending on where the study was actually performed, the prevalence can be quite different. And so it's hard to calculate an accurate incidence of H. pylori-related upper gastrointestinal bleeding. And the other thing is that a lot of studies that looked at the interaction with Helicobacter pylori and upper gastrointestinal bleeding, what we found anyway in our literature search, was that they mainly did so in the context of looking at the recurrence of upper gastrointestinal bleeding after the infection was treated appropriately.
Yes.
And they did show that there was a lower recurrence. Well, they can't use that data to calculate an incidence per se, but because there's a recurrence, that suggests that there's at least an etiological relationship. So that's why it's quite hard. The incidence of aspirin-related gastrointestinal bleeding, that is also quite broad, but the numbers are a little bit clearer. People quote somewhere between 0.1 to 1 event per 100 patient years. Even though it's small, there's still that tenfold range, which is quite wide.
Yeah. Why did you decide on this project? Why a meta-analysis of this particular interaction between low-dose aspirin and H. pylori?
Yes. The American and European guidelines, they do recommend before you start low-dose aspirin therapy to test for H. pylori serology. Mm-hmm. But they do put a caveat in that they say that they acknowledge that the evidence for this is weak. That's why we decided to look at it, because the evidence that they based that recommendation on is actually, one, indirect, and two, there was actually, we think, conflicting evidence. That recommendation, they largely based it on a meta-analysis, which looked at studies that mainly included patients who were taking conventional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs other than low-dose aspirin. So the difference between conventional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and low-dose aspirin, they both inhibit the enzyme cyclooxygenase 1, which is what lowers the prostaglandin production in the stomach lining, and that's what makes it prone to having ulcers and therefore bleeding. But low-dose aspirin also causes upper gastrointestinal bleeding by stopping the platelets from aggregating, which would otherwise stop an ulcer from bleeding. And so because that meta-analysis mainly looked at conventional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, you can't directly apply it to low-dose aspirin because there's that extra mechanism. So that's why we thought it was indirect. And in terms of the evidence being conflicting, in studies that did look at low-dose aspirin, one study showed that there was no difference found between the rates of recurrence of upper gastrointestinal bleeding in Helicobacter pylori-positive patients taking low-dose aspirin who had the infection eradicated and who were simply just started on a PPI. So that was odd. But then there was also another study that found a low incident of reoccurrence of upper gastrointestinal bleeding in Helicobacter pylori-infected aspirin users after the eradication of the infection. There's another randomized control trial that showed that the reoccurrence of upper gastrointestinal bleeding in low-dose aspirin users at 12 months after eradication was as high as 15%. So there's one study that found low reoccurrence, another found that it was higher at 15, and then there was another study that showed there's no difference between eradicating it or just leaving it there and putting them on a PPI. So the evidence wasn't very clear.
No.
So that's why we looked at it.
So tell us what your major results were from your meta-analysis.
So what we found was that on patients who take low-dose aspirin, if you have a Helicobacter pylori infection, then it roughly doubles the odds of having an upper gastrointestinal bleed. And even all our sensitivity analyses, they all showed a very similar result.
I'm chatting with Justin Ng, and we are talking about low-dose aspirin and its possible interactions with H. pylori. You can find his meta-analysis at mja.com.au. When you say H. pylori infection, does that mean you've got the bug in your system and it's causing symptoms, or are we talking about people who have it but it's not giving them symptoms?
Both. Well, the papers that we included, they tested for Helicobacter pylori with a few different methods. One was serology, which we know does have some limitations. It doesn't necessarily indicate current infection. There's a common misconception that once you do have the infection, the serology stays positive for life, but that's not true. After 12 months, half of people will go back to being negative, and then the other half have titers that are much lower than when they did have the infection. So that was a side point. And then the other ways was the other ways they tested was, you know, urea, breath test, biopsies, when they did the gastroscopies, when they looked at the patients.
You know, when somebody says you have an infection, I think average people say, therefore you feel sick. But if you're asymptomatic, you can still have the infection, as it were.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Do you think the guidelines should, or clinical practice should, change so that people who are about to be put on low-dose aspirin are also tested for H. pylori?
That's a very straightforward question, but the answer is not a straightforward. So the current guidelines actually already recommend quite a sensible approach because they recommend that we should be testing everyone about to start low-dose aspirin or Helicobacter pylori. But the evidence was poor. Our meta-analysis provides more robust evidence now to support that recommendation, which is good. But in terms of how often that's actually being done at the moment, there's no published data for low-dose aspirin. There is published data for people who, before they start non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and there's a similar recommendation for that. And they found roughly, I think, less than 20% of doctors would test their patients prior to starting a non-steroidal. Anecdotally, some of our cardiology colleagues that we asked as we were, you know, looking through all these articles, basically they never think about Helicobacter pylori before they start on low-dose aspirin.
Is that a lack of awareness about whatever evidence there is, or is Or is there a little bit of the cardiologist not being confident about treating basically a gastrointestinal bug?
Yes, I think there's a component of both.
Right.
One is that there's the lack of awareness of the evidence, and you know, before this paper, there wasn't really much evidence.
Yeah.
But as also with the Helicobacter pylori, and particularly because of some of the increasing antimicrobial resistance to previous therapies. I mean, there's now people saying that you should be using quadruple therapy rather than the traditional two antibiotics and a proton pump inhibitor. So it's changing, and the resistance is changing, and so the therapy is also changing. And yeah, it's a gastrointestinal condition, so cardiologists it doesn't come naturally to them to think about it. Even neurologists, even in patients who have a stroke and need to start low-dose aspirin, it doesn't necessarily come to mind, which is understandable.
If I'm a GP and a patient walks in and you know, you've got a history with them, and you know that you want to get them on low-dose aspirin, if I'm a GP, should I be automatically testing them for HBAC?
We don't think so necessarily, because first of all, it takes a lot of time to treat the infection, because I think it's quite a prolonged course of antibiotics and proton pump inhibitors.
Yes.
And then the patients need to have testing for it before and after to ensure that the eradication has actually been successful. So not only does that take up lots of testing, a high pill burden for the patients, but also a high burden for GPs as well. We calculate the numbers needed to treat as being somewhere between 150 to 1,500 patients before you can prevent one extra bleed a year.
Okay.
And so that number needed to treat is quite large. Applying a blanket rule would not be.
Because basically the relative risk is double, but the absolute risk is still quite small.
Exactly. Anyone who would be at a higher risk of developing just peptic ulcers in general should be tested for and treated. And so, like, we know that the risk factors are taking a conventional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug as a past history of upper gastrointestinal bleeding, smoking, and increasing age.
So it's a case of picking the right patient.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Thanks, Justin.
Okay, no worries.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.